someone like you. And I feel right by your side. Lay your troubles on my shoulders. Put your worries in my pocket. Rest your life.
When someone need love, the they call for this, right?
Has come, and the land is dark, and the moon is the only light we'll see.
You know, you take a couple and you're walking outside, and a pretty bloom night, moonlight, light shine, and you just have a walk, this and walk, and sit on the park.
Oh, I won't
memories.
Be afraid, just as long as you stand. Stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand. Stand by me. Stand by me.
I say after hours right here, I'm going to play one more tune and then I play the mama song for Miss Anne, right?
One should tumble and fall.
I will continue with this next week, same place, same time. Give it a little bit of a little dance. After hours, right here, I'm going to take you one or two out of here. Whatever you do this weekend, be good. Enjoy your Easter. Kick your little one of them to church, and I see it. Yeah. Give them a little blessing of them heart, and I see it.
Honey, you are my shining star.
This one reaching out to that beautiful queen uptown.
Yeah, baby. So many have tried to find a love like yours and mine. Mm-hmm. Girl, don't you realize how you hypnotize? Make me love you more each time. Oh, my, oh, my. Oh, mama, don't cry.
Miss Anne, that song for you, right?
Gonna keep you by the blood so high.
Reaching out to all the mothers in the world. Sometimes it's just the way things are to be, yeah.
Thank you, mama, for the 9 months you carried me through. All those pain and suffering. No one knows the pressure you bear, just only you. Give you all my love, oh yeah. Thank you, mama, for the 9 months you carried me through.
Do you realize consciousness is affected? There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize our consciousness is affected? There is this thing going on.
What is called the news brought to you live.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show, a part of CKUT's Off the Hour. Prison Radio has been on the air for more than 10 years. Prison Radio seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggle by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging our ideas about what are prisons and the people inside our jails. Prison Radio is dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. This is in the interest of forging stronger ties with incarcerated and non-incarcerated people, ensuring that prisoners have direct control over their representation and that our understanding of prisons be informed by those who live inside their walls. We invite anyone who is interested in collaborating on programming to contact us. Those who have been affected by the prison system in any way are encouraged to get involved. You can email news@cqt.ca or prison@cqt.ca, or you can call us at 514-448-4041, extension 6788. You are listening to CQUT, Montreal Community Campus Radio, located on 90.3 FM on the dial and www.cqut.ca online.
You're listening to The Prison Radio Show. My name is Noah, and I'm your host for today's show. Today on The Prison Radio Show, we'll be speaking with a member of the Mi'kmaq Warrior Society who was incarcerated for her involvement in a 2013 Sacred Fire Ceremony and blockade against a shale gas exploration company near El Sabaktuk in so-called New Brunswick. We'll also be hearing a part of a presentation on queer prison justice by Ardath Wynacht, who teaches poetry at Dorchester Penitentiary in Mi'kmaq Territory in so-called New Brunswick. But first, we'll start the show with some news. Former Black Panther and political prisoner Jalil Muntakim is out of the segregated housing unit where he had been placed since December after being hit with disciplinary charges by the prison for teaching Black history inside. Jalil has now been placed in a closed supervision unit at Shawanaga Prison in Wallkill, New York. Jalil is fighting his placement in the CSU. You can find a new address to write him at freejalil.com. An immigration detainee organizer in the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario, has informed outside organizers that a new visitor policy has come down the pipes at that prison as of last week. Visitors to the prison will now have to book an appointment for a visit at least 24 hours in advance of the visit date. Prisoners are now being required to fulfill a visits authorization form, and only visitors listed on the form will be permitted to book an appointment. Prisoners are only being allowed to put six names on their forms. Immigration detainees are being told they need to include the birth dates of their visitors on the forms. The End Immigration Detention Network is asking outside supporters to call the prison and demand they scrap the policy. You can reach the prison at 705-328-6000. Again, that's 705-328-6000. You can also call the Ministry of Community Safety and Correctional Services to file a complaint. 416-326-5000. April 17th is the International Day of Solidarity with Palestinian Prisoners. Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network urges all organizations and groups that support justice, liberation, and Palestinian freedom to organize events from the 14th to the 25th of April in support of Palestinian prisoners, the prisoners' movement's collective hunger strikes and demands, and the demand to end security coordination. For more info, visit their website at samidun.net. That's samidoun.net. In Riverside, California, prisoners at the Robert Presley Detention Center's Administrative Segregation Unit have organized a fast from April 13th to May 1st to protest frivolous and irrelevant policies at the prisons, placement in solitary confinement, when there exists no serious rule violations to merit such placement, denial of adequate clothing to prisoners, and prices for food in the commissary, among other issues. The prisoners are demanding opportunities for religious services, self-help, and education programming, an end to housing prisoners with mental health problems in the general population, and the establishment of accountability for each grievance to catalog the concerns of prisoners. For more information, visit prisonerhungerstrikesolidarity.wordpress.com. Next up, we have an interview with Suzanne, a member of the Mi'kmaq Warrior Society, who was arrested and incarcerated during the struggle against shale gas exploration in El Sabaktuk in so-called New Brunswick. She joined us on the phone earlier this week to discuss her nation's sovereignty, the criminalization of all Indigenous peoples, as well as her experience of arrest, incarceration, and threat of eviction.
First of all, Suzanne, thank you for joining us here on the Prison Radio Show on SQT. Thanks for speaking with us. I'm hoping that you can tell us a little bit about your story of your run-ins with the law, and maybe you can take us back to some of the events in 2013. Why were you arrested in 2013?
Okay, I was arrested actually 3 different times in 2013. The first time that I was arrested was for a performance ceremony on Highway 126. And I was arrested and remanded and taken into a court and I was placed on like heavy conditions where I wasn't allowed near any fracking development or exploration. And so I was arrested again for, and these charges were like mischief and, you know, just little charges like that. They were like misdemeanor charges, but they were being enforced upon me as if they were federal court charges. So those first two times it was, the first time was for having ceremony, and the second time was for when we had a blockade, a direct action blockade, where we stopped their vehicles, exited in the woods, and we had ceremony performed in the woods where they were doing their development, and I was charged for that several weeks later. It didn't happen at the time, but like they laid those charges down later. So all the while we were fighting the fracking company, I was representing myself in court, where I was my own lawyer. And because of the conditions that they put me on, I was requesting a conditional hearing, where I was fighting the fact that they were hindering my ability to freely roam my territory. So we were undergoing a court process for that, and the court wouldn't even uphold Supreme Court law, where they were denying that the quote was from the Crown Prosecutor was, "I was instructed to not consent to your Aboriginal descent," meaning that he wanted me to prove my ancestry, even though Supreme Court case decision already set forth a justification test to prove an Aboriginal right, to present your status card, and to the Moncton Court, the status card wasn't good enough. So I was undergoing those kind of judicial processes, and then we had the blockade on 134, which is just off Highway 11 in so-called Brunswick, and they came in and raided us on October 17th. 2013, and we were beat down and arrested again on that day. And all of my charges ended up getting dropped in November, but they held several of our members of the Mi'kmaq Warrior Society as political prisoners of war, and who subsequently were not released until well over a year after they were first incarcerated, because the court process took so long, and it was just a really stretched out judicial system where our people don't face justice. Like, there's always injustice, there's no justice in their court system or on the internet.
Maybe you can explain why there were blockades? I guess, why was your community against fracking?
Oh, well, we were against this kind of development because this kind of development poisons the water on a level that no other extraction resource industry has ever tried to poison our waters before in our territory. Like, we've had industrial development, but this type of development heightens the risk to our pristine water sources in our territory. So because water is sacred, and because as women we have a responsibility to protect that, and as a warrior society, it is our duty to protect the women who are asserting their rights on the ground and assert their responsibility to adhere to our Creator's promises that we will take care of our territory and we will keep water sacred. We will protect it.
What did your experiences teach you about the nature of policing in prisons?
Well, what I learned was there are different diverse tactics when dealing with direct action. We also learned the willingness of the police to want to kill us for making our stand, because several officers, while we were in court, stated that they had their finger squeezed that trigger more than once. And you know, they stated this right in the courtroom. So if, you know, they're willing to say that in the courtroom, it just goes to show how intense and how severe that they were willing to take that stand. And within the whole justice system, it's just as corrupt as the government, because we will never face justice within their court systems. And according to the treaties of my territory, any dispute between the settler and the indigenous is supposed to be settled through civil adjudication. And if we cannot be in the colonizers' courtrooms when doing this, we need third-party adjudication. So the court processes are not fair. And I think that there needs to be reform for a better system, where we're able to work together yet be able to work apart. And when there is a dispute that arises, to have an avenue where it is not the colonizers' court and not the colonizers' rule that are going to rule. So it's very important that to note that when my people have asserted their rights in my territory, that we've always been criminalized, whether it be for fishing, whether it be for hunting, whether it be for the protection of water. Anytime any one of my people has asserted their rights in our territory, we have been criminalized, and we end up having to bring that fight all the way to Supreme Court, where our rights become further litigated. And that is not what our people want. We don't want our rights to be litigated or negated again, and for the government to tell us how we should be certain, or how should we be living our lives. So it's important that we're able to keep ourselves well organized, so that when we do fall into these types of situations, that we will be able to beat the oppressor at their own game, so to speak.
You're right. The RCMP has a terrible track record of targeting Aboriginal peoples as well. And I'm wondering if you could maybe speak more about maybe the links between resource extractive industries and the police and Aboriginal peoples.
Well, it's even like just the police in general with Aboriginal people. The police were the ones who were helping the government round up our children to ship them off to residential schools. The police were the ones who were dragging our people out of our homes when they had tuberculosis, and putting the older people in handcuffs and taking them away from their homes as if they were criminals. And when my people were trying to assert their, you know, it's not even an assertion, it's just a way of life. When we were sitting around, because I'm from a gambling nation, and when we were sitting around gambling, playing our traditional games, the police would come in and do a raid. They would take everything that was on the table and arrest people, you know, just for gathering, so, and for playing these games. And it's, no matter what we have done, we've always been criminalized. And in the case, when it comes to resource extraction, they always take the side of resource industrial people because of the money trail. These people have the money, and it's a shame that police force will always take the side of the person who has the money. Like, you know, there were some women who were hit by SWN security, and no charges were ever laid by the police for this. And it's very sad and unfortunate when Indigenous people have a legitimate claim or complaint that they're not listened to. So my people are not listened to, and that's another issue when dealing with resource extraction, is that these companies fabricate lies in order to incarcerate our people, in order to create criminals out of us. And we're not criminals, we're just trying to save the earth.
What do you think can be done in order to get Aboriginal peoples out of jails, out of Canadian jails right now?
Well, in order to get our people out of jail is, none of our people belong in jail. We need to be asserting our own authority over our territories. Every Indigenous person who is incarcerated is a political prisoner of war, because Canada has no authority over my people. The only so-called authority that they hold is when they illegally made the Constitution and put in their Section 9124, Indians and Lands Reserved for Indians. That is their only so-called authority that they have over my people all across Turtle Island here, and, well, in Canada specifically. And it is very sad that this is the rule that the colonizer has been using for, now we're at 141 years of the Indian Act system, and we're now at 150 years since Confederation. And it's just fairly disheartening to see how far the system is willing to go in order to, you know, take my people out of the question. And the first concentration camps were the reservations, where they placed us on these tiny parcels of land and stole the rest of our territories, and they made us have passes. We weren't allowed to leave the reservation, or we would be arrested. So since the colonizer came, it has been very political to even be Indigenous, where there has been so many imposed policies and rules set out against my people for any of our movements to become illegal. Because we were able to get legal representation until they put legislation through that we weren't people, and that we could not get any lawyers to represent us in court. So it wasn't until 1960 when we were recognized as so-called Canadian citizens, we were able to get legal representation.
Suzanne, maybe you could tell us a little bit about your experiences getting out of jail. Usually when people get out of jail, they still need lots of support. And so maybe you can tell us why you and your family are facing eviction, and what can listeners do to support you?
Okay, well, right now in my community, my landlord owns a residential oil company. So ever since I started a fight with oil companies in general, I think he's a bit paranoid and thinking that I'm going to attack him next, but he's just a little community residential oil company, and I have bigger issues, like, outside of my community, that I wasn't going to bring that fight home. And unfortunately, he brought that fight right to my doorstep by attempting to evict me several times by word of mouth just for stupid reasons, such as his step falling apart and he was trying to get the blame to me, and such as parking in the wrong places and getting his daughter to make noise complaints. And so he put an eviction notice on my door, and then he tried to get the police in my community, who are RCMP, to serve me the notice. So for a week, I was arguing with the police, saying that what they were doing was illegal, and they felt like they had the authority to do so. And it wasn't until I had threatened them with a lawsuit, and I was filing a formal complaint after five of their officers for them attempting to serve me an eviction notice on behalf of the landlord. All the while they were doing this, they stole my papers for my vehicle. They had my registration and insurance as hostage and wouldn't give me that unless they were able to serve me. So I filed a complaint against them, and they closed the file on the eviction notice, and they returned my documentation for my vehicle back to my sister. So it's been an ever-ending battle with this landlord for quite some time, and he's even tried to get the police to side with him. And as you've seen with resource industry, the police always try to take the side of whoever has the most money, and my landlord is one of the richest individuals in my community. So it's not an easy battle when you're facing somebody who has that kind of power, but I don't back down to a fight.
And what can listeners do to support you?
Right now, they could share, like, there's several links being shared online regarding my housing situation, and I have a email address set up for monetary donations if anybody wanted to do so to help me with either moving costs or court costs, depending on where this fight is going to go. I'm currently negotiating a few things with the bond council, trying to figure out what exactly the situation is, because the landlord gave a quote of the bond manager saying that he was told to just get rid of me, which is a scary quote, especially when you're always fighting the system, and for that kind of thing to be said, you know, to just get rid of me. And this is the reason why we have Indigenous murdered and missing women, because our women are disregarded and, like, treated as if we were disposable.
Yeah, well, we'll share the link on our blog.
Okay.
Thanks again for joining us here on the Prison Radio Show. Was there anything else you wanted to add generally about the criminalization of, all First Nations people defending the land, or anything else you wanted to add about your case specifically?
What I want to add about, like, Indigenous political prisoners of war is we need to never forget about them. Like, at the time our warriors were incarcerated, they were the only political prisoners of war in North America at the moment. So we need to be raising them up while they're incarcerated. We need to be providing them with the supports that they need while they're in there, like to have money for their canteen and to have their lawyers you know, paid for, and for them to have people write them letters thanking them for their sacrifice, because it's a very big sacrifice being incarcerated. And also, like, when to not stop that when they come out, to honor them for their sacrifice. And, like, it's very important to, like, honor these people who do the time, to honor them for their sacrifice, because everybody has family, and a lot of reasons why people won't put their lives on the line is because they want to be home with their families. But the ones who do put their lives on the line, they're taking all of that time out of their lives to provide justice and fairness and to assert their rights. And and it's difficult when they get incarcerated because they're taking the momentum out of the movement, and we don't need to stop the momentum. We need to continue the momentum for the struggle and also for the ones who are incarcerated, and to provide them with the best supports and resources available, and to also fight the prison system to recognize and honor Indigenous spirituality, because that's one of the problems we had in our territory, was being able to have our men access elders and smudging and prayer time for them. And it's a human right complaint, you know, like it's something serious. Like, these systems are totally ignoring the law, and they're getting away with it. And it doesn't matter where our people are, there's always injustice.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your fighting. Was there anything else you wanted to add? Most of our listeners are people in jail. There are many jails in Laval, and then there are lots of jails in upstate New York. So most of our listeners are people in prison, and disproportionately, of course, First Nations people, Aboriginal people, are overrepresented in prisons.
Yes, it is a very big number of our people being incarcerated. And, you know, they need to know that their fight isn't alone on the inside, and that they can reach out and fight the system inside as if they were on the outside, because it's all the same, and they need to be advocating hard on the inside and know that there's people on the outside who are also fighting against that system that's being you know, imposed upon them.
That was Suzanne, Mi'kmaq warrior. For more information about her Eviction Defense Fund, visit ReclaimTurtleIsland.com and click on the link Support Grassroots Land Defender and Mi'kmaq Warrior Suzanne Paddles. The time is presently 5:32 p.m. and you're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. Before we get to our next interview, we have some more news. We have a lot of news today. As of April 5th, 2017, some maximum security prisoners at South Mississippi Correctional Institution are on a hunger strike to protest their harsh, inhumane treatment. According to the Clarion Ledger, 23 prisoners at the prison in Leakesville, Mississippi, are on hunger strike. Prisoners say they are locked down 24 hours a day without a possibility of outside recreation, and also talked about a lack of visitation, inadequate or missing lighting, non-working toilets, and broken bedding. On Friday, March 31st, Mayor of New York City Bill de Blasio announced a 10-year plan to close Rikers Island Prison. According to the New York Daily News, de Blasio didn't announce specifics of the plan, but talked about opening new prisons elsewhere in New York City. On March 29th, the New York Daily News announced that New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo has backed off a proposal to slash the number of visitation days that families of prisoners at maximum security state prisons would be allowed. Listeners to the Prison Radio Show might remember that we reported on this a few months ago when the proposal was first made. Cuomo agreed to restore $2.6 million to fund the 39 positions needed to allow visitations every day. New York lawmakers are also claiming to be nearing a deal to raise the age that a teen can be charged as an adult from 16 to 18. Sadiq Abdullah Hassan and Jason Robb, both prisoners who were involved in the Lucasville uprising in Ohio in 1993, have both ended their hunger strikes. Hassan and Robb were both interviewed for a Netflix documentary series about the Lucasville uprising, after which prison officials instituted a 90-day restriction against both men's access to phone, email, and video visit communication. Hassan and Robb were both on hunger strike for more than 3 weeks. Both have now ended their hunger strikes due to health concerns. As of March 31st, Pennsylvania State Department of Corrections officials have told Mumia Abu-Jamal that they will provide him with the hepatitis C fast-acting antiviral treatment beginning the first week of April. In court, the Department of Corrections filed a status report declaring that they were going to treat Mumia after losing their Third Circuit appeal in a bid to deny Mumia treatment. For more information on Mumia's health situation, you can visit prisonradio.org. Next up, we have an interview with Ardath Weinacht, a sociology professor at Mount Allison University who teaches poetry and performance at Dorchester Penitentiary on Mi'kmaq territory in so-called New Brunswick. She gave several public lectures around the Maritimes in February and March about carceral state violence in queer, trans, and two-spirit lives. This is a brief excerpt from the talk she delivered at Dalhousie University in Halifax.
A note, I'm going to be talking a little bit about issues related to self-harm, suicide, and sexual assault. Those of you who maybe have been to my workshops before know that I don't give a TW, but instead I'd like to say, if you feel things in this space, that's perfectly fine. If you need to leave, that's perfectly fine. Just don't leave alone and stay alone as you're feeling those things. Okay. So my goals are threefold this evening. I'd like to explore queerness as an embodied experience in Canadian prisons, both federal and provincial. And this includes the everyday experiences of queer and trans folks living in institutions, but also in their contact with police and their progress through the court system. But first, I would also like to consider the notion of queerness as a theoretical space in which we can reconsider the institution of law and our notions of security and violence. I hope that by briefly exploring queer theory and revisiting issues related to the gender binary, that we can undo some of the language and concepts that we often take for granted, especially when we talk about things like violence, harm, and trauma. And I think that by trying to undo the language around this and open it up a little bit, this will lead us to a better understanding of the social processes that render queer and trans people more vulnerable to effects of violence. Finally, I'm going to talk about seven concrete ways in which I think we can forge a better movement for queer prison justice. So first, a few definitions. So I will be using the term queer to refer to sexual orientations and gender identities that don't conform to heterosexual and cisgender norms. At times I may say queer and trans, and I'm doing this not to say that the trans experience isn't inherently queer. I'm saying that out of respect and acknowledgement that trans histories were largely excluded in mainstream gay and lesbian rights movements for a long time, so it's just my form of linguistic reparation. I'm also going to be using the term justice. So I mean justice both in the institutional sense, but also in broader social senses. So when I use the term justice tonight, I urge you to think about it not only within your context of being emerging legal practitioners, but also what that term means in terms of your friendships, chosen kinships, and also your intimate relationships. I realize that most, if not all of you, are law students, unless you are concerned with details. Details, specific cases, dates, precedents, that's not what I'm going to talk about tonight, so I apologize if I'm not meeting your needs, but I do hope that by exploring these narratives through what I've come to learn in my own research, we can think conceptually. So let me explain briefly my own research background. So I have an interest in queer prison justice because I've been working in Canadian prisons since 2008. So I'm a sociologist with a background in literary and performance arts, and I came to work in prisons because I received a call from the warden of a federal women's facility out of the blue who asked me to come in and teach a poetry workshop. And the reason they thought I was the person for the job is because I'd been working with sex workers through Stepping Stone to deliver a creative way to talk about workplace safety when doing street-based sex work. And as in the way that the warden phrased it, she said, I need someone familiar with our population, which means women who are on methadone and have experienced trauma. I learned later that I was hired on contract with funds made available after the death of Ashley Smith. Raise your hand if you're familiar with the Ashley Smith case. Okay. So I was implicated in the prison industrial complex because I was part of a PR move on behalf of the feds to make it look like they were providing programming in the maximum security unit and in segregation. So I worked for quite a few years with women in segregation and in the MAX unit, and I work now in Dorchester Penitentiary in New Brunswick, and I work with men serving lifelong sentences as well. In terms of my research, what I'm interested in trauma and harm, and the ways in which the institution of law, and in some cases the institution of medicine, tend to perpetuate, exacerbate, or render invisible particular experiences of violence that we don't think about as violence. Okay, So that's what I'm interested in. And I approach justice from an emotional standpoint. So for the purposes of this talk, know that I am a prison abolitionist. And I'm not going to go into that today because Ryan's going to do a way better job than me of talking about that in March. But know that I'm invested in transformative justice as a process that changes social conditions rather than using the punitive model of incarceration. So now you know my biases. Let's begin. We're in the max unit of a women's prison. Offenders are housed in two pods. Each one has room for four offenders. The pods are completely separate. They do this on purpose in case two women get into a fight so they can keep the pods as far apart as possible. The individual units within the pods are separated with cement block and plexiglass. The segregation unit is down another hallway. It's quite close. The doors in the seg unit are steel and they have a locked meal, a tray, or a notebook through. We meet in a room that serves double duty as a meeting space and a classroom. There's a shelf with what should be books, but it's mostly fashion magazines that are donated by the correctional officers when they're done with them. And there are a few scattered tables and orange chairs, the same kind that you probably had in your high school. One wall is completely transparent. It's a plexiglass barrier that faces what looks like the front of a tractor trailer. It's the guard tower. So it's sort of a wraparound plexiglass space in which the guards sit, illuminated blue from all of the screens from surveillance feeds in the unit. So know that the unit has a lot of structure for a space that is pretty tiny and only really houses eight offenders at a time, plus maybe two in a seg unit if it's full. Inside the classroom, there are six of us, five plus me. We're meeting to write poetry, review their homework, review their creative work, their drawings, and to think about creative ways to develop their writing and communication skills. So three of the five offenders that are in the room are queer. Two of them are in a relationship with each other, and one of them, I'm fairly certain, is someone who's on the trans spectrum, but they don't claim to be because they don't know what the trans spectrum is. They've never been introduced to thinking about gender identity in that way. All three of the queer offenders in my class are incarcerated for violent crimes that are drug-related. All three have trauma histories. Two self-harm regularly. Forearms with scars, red and purple, from the wrist to the elbow. All three are struggling to get sober in a unit where security concerns make it really difficult for them to participate in programs that offenders in general population would have access to. So you need to have your security clearance at a certain level before you can be escorted by a guard down to participate in programs. The two women who are currently dating did not identify as queer before coming to prison. Both were raised in abusive religious homes, one in Labrador and one in St. John's, Newfoundland. In attempts to flee the violence of intergenerational abuse in their homes, they fled to different cities, and they made a living either in the drug trade or in sex work. One of the three queer women was sexually assaulted by her OxyContin dealer for years and years until she was arrested and he was later arrested for those crimes. So I can see that their relationship together is tender. And queer love within the prison is something that's kind of beautiful because it is a space of violence and isolation. They support each other in their healing. One is being transferred soon to a facility in another province, and that's panic-inducing, and there have been a lot of tears. So although officially offenders aren't really permitted to have relationships with each other, certainly not sexual relationships, as long as nobody's having sex, breaking rules, or creating too much drama, in my experience, I see correctional officers turning a blind eye to this, and sort of letting the women, at least in the women's facility, have their relationships. Or scrapbooking. We're cutting out paper hearts and bits of brightly colored paper to give as poem gifts to send out in the mail. One is writing a love poem for her son, who's currently in foster care. One is writing a poem for her partner, who's sitting right next to her. And the third, the most masculine, is writing a sex poem about a married woman she had an affair with before she robbed her house and fled from the cops. So all three of these women bear the physical and emotional scars of state, family, and intimate partner violence. They have all tried to self-soothe and heal with addiction. They have all come from chronically poor neighborhoods that are affected by colonization and the pressures of neoliberal global capitalism, which has gutted social services budgets at the municipal and provincial levels. In many ways, their stories although they are queer stories, are not much different from the other heterosexual or cisgendered women in the prison. But if we play a numbers game, we can say with certainty that queer people are drastically overrepresented in the Canadian prison system. But despite this, queer and trans people are not officially counted as a minority population in official reports, say those from the prison ombudsman. Nor is there a strong movement here in Canada to interrogate and disrupt the processes that render queer and trans people more vulnerable to victimization and incarceration. So hold on to this point. Hold on to the idea of queer and trans folks being overrepresented, and hold on to this idea that there's not really a conversation about that at the national level or in advocacy organizations. That's not to say there isn't really great activism going on in this area, because luckily there is.
That was an excerpt from a public talk delivered by Professor Ardath Wynocht at Dalhousie School of Law on Queering the Carceral Landscape, GLBTQI Narratives of quote-unquote Justice and Imprisonment in Canada.
Selling fine. Her mother grows angry. Retribution will be swift. We squander her soil and suck out her sweet black blood to burn it. We turn money into God and salivate over opportunities to crumple and crinkle our souls for that paper, that gold. Money has spent us, left us in small boxes, dark rooms, bright screens, empty tombs, left investing our time in hollow philosophies to placate the fear of our bodies returning back into our mother. Demand awakening. Ignite, stand upright, and conduct yourself like lightning, because the retribution will be swift.
Oh, say, hey, 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 hey.
That was the song No No Keshegesh by the singular Buffy St. Marie, followed by the song Retribution by Tanya Tagak from her 2016 album of the same name. The time is presently 5:57 p.m., and you've been listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. You can check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Prison Radio Show. The Prison Radio Show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday at 11 a.m. The next Prison Radio Show will air on Friday, April 28th at 11 a.m. If you have any questions on anything that you've heard on today's show, or if you wish to be involved with the show, feel free to contact us at prison@ckut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are encouraged to participate. Folks can also leave a message on our listener comment line at 514-448-4041, extension 2547. If you're in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. Feel free to write us at The Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, postal code H3A2B3. Thanks for tuning into The Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name's Noah, and I've been your host for today. Please stay tuned.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? Brought to you live.